Good afternoon, everybody. I want to welcome you to the United States Institute of Peace and thank you for coming out today, which for what I think for us and Afghanistan, but also the U.S. Institute of Peace personally, is a very exciting event. And it's principally around the publication of this report, which I assume most or all of you managed to grab a copy of. This is Afghanistan's Human Development Report for 2007. And the thing that is remarkable about this report from our perspective is that it focuses on the rule of law. And the rule of law program at the U.S. Institute of Peace has been working on rule of law issues in Afghanistan since 2001. And it's something that we feel very strongly is not only an important part of the equation in figuring out how Afghanistan is going to recover from its miseries of the last several decades, but it is in fact a keystone element of that. If you look at each year, I think, since 2001, there's often a new issue rises to the fore. So one year it may be it's the Rhodes stupid year, where the strategy is primarily to think about how we can expand physically out into the hinterland. Another year it's security stupid year, or it's opium stupid year. And I think this year we have finally arrived at it's the rule of law stupid year. This summer in Rome, there was an international conference for Afghanistan that focused on the importance of the rule of law in the country as a cornerstone for progress. And I think one of the reasons that we have arrived at this, and why I think Dr. Wardock's Center and the UN Development Program believed so rightly that rule of law was a critical focus to looking at human development in Afghanistan, is because it's really central to every aspect of the recovery, whether it's economic or security, having to do with people's rights, basic rights to work, to go to school, or having to do with the overall functioning of the political system, the ability of the president and the parliament to work out their differences in a way that's in accordance with the Constitution. So really, from top to bottom and all across the spectrum, rule of law is really one of the keystone issues. And I'll let Dr. Wardock focus on that further. One of the other things that we are really thrilled about with this report is that Ali and I think, have been on something of a crusade for the last 5 years to bring attention to...
Poor choice of words.
maybe, but jihad. Yeah, we've been on a personal jihad for the last 5 years to bring attention to something that is absolutely fundamental to Afghanistan's recovery and to the rule of law in Afghanistan, and that is recognition of the powerful informal system that functions in Afghanistan, and that for many people is not only the primary but is the exclusive means by which they resolve their problems. And Ali and I, along with Chris Johnson and Bill Maley, wrote a report in 2002 highlighting informal structures as a key component of governance and the way forward, particularly in the justice sector, and actually commented on that report that it seemed unfortunate at the time that so few within the international community seemed willing or able to pay attention to that issue. I think that there has been a dramatic shift, and I think that this report, in addition to work that USIP has been doing in Afghanistan, including a national conference in December of last year that brought together tribal leaders and government leaders from all over the country to deal with this issue. This concept, I think, is finally seeping into the common understanding of what Afghanistan's future holds and how governance really works in Afghanistan. So I'm very excited about that, and I think that there's real progress being made. Unfortunately, one of the things that this report also points out in great detail is that in many ways progress is not being made. In Afghanistan, 2004 was the first human development report that came out, and Afghanistan was ranked 173 of 177 nations on Earth. And that's the bottom, of course, not the top of the index. And it's hard to say, depending on how you count it and which countries are included each year, but at least officially its rank slipped to 174th this year, which means a lot of things, and the numbers need to be unpacked. But the fundamental importance there is that 6 years on into the international intervention in Afghanistan and 3 years since the last report, there is evidently, on a macro scale, a lack of progress or even some setbacks, and something that I think we all need to be gravely concerned about. I will let Ali introduce this report to us and some of its most interesting findings, and he'll speak for about 15 minutes. And then, as many of you know, unfortunately we don't have the bio sheets out here. Ali Wardock is a professor, has been a professor at the University of Glamorgan. He focuses on criminology, but has spent a significant amount of his time in the last 5 years. He's an Afghan by birth and was educated there before going on to get his PhD in the UK. But he has returned to Afghanistan to do some very important work over the last several years. And he is now the senior researcher at the Center for Policy and Human Development, which is a new institute at Kabul University. And I'll just introduce him now, although I think that Dr. Barney Rubin almost goes without introduction when it comes to Afghanistan-related issues. He is a senior fellow and director of studies at the Center on International Cooperation at New York University. He is the longstanding chair of our Afghanistan working group here. He's written some of the most influential and important books on Afghanistan over the last two decades. I'm sure, as always, he will enlighten us with comments about this report as well. So over to you, Ali.
Good afternoon. Alex, thank you very much for your kind introduction. I don't want to spend time on the relation between USIP and myself and our center, but Alex and I have worked together on quite a few projects, and I'm very pleased to be here with you today. As you could see from the screen, the main focus of Afghanistan National Human Development Report this year is the rule of law. And of course, as expected, the report involves analysis of key issues relating to human development and rule of law, such as education, health, GDP, and of course, other cross-cutting issues. Also, the report involves analysis of key challenges to security in Afghanistan, such as past crimes, counter-narcotics, lack of security or the increasing lack of security, and corruption in the government and in the society as a whole. However, as I have just 15 minutes, it is beyond the scope of this presentation to go to all these issues. So I'm going to focus on Afghanistan justice institutions that are central both to the rule of law and to human development. So my presentation briefly is divided into three parts. In part one, I'll be looking at the current state of formal justice institutions in Afghanistan. So the way we inherited the institutions and the way they are today. And secondly, I'll be looking at informal mechanism and institutions of dispute settlement in Afghanistan, which are responsible for about 80% of dispute resolution in the country. And finally, I'll be focusing on one of the main recommendations of this report, which is about a hybrid model of formal and informal justice. And of course, we have quite a few recommendations, but I'll be also proposing how this model could be adopted and introduced. First of all, the current administration and the post-war governments and administrations inherited a justice system, if you call it as a system, in inverted commas, which was badly damaged. The damage did not only include physical damage or damage to the physical infrastructure of justice institutions, but also the justice system lacked qualified judges, attorneys, police officers, and prison wardens. And it was a huge task for the post-Taliban administration to rebuild and strengthen those institutions. Efforts have been made to strengthen those institutions and to rebuild them. There has been modest progress. Sorry, I think the font is a bit small. I should have increased that. But the progress mainly involves capacity building and professional training. In fact, both United States, USAID, Max Planck Institute, and IDLO in Rome have been involved in the training of Afghan judicial professionals. So far, about between 500 to 600 judges and attorneys have been trained. Also, the Afghan traditional, or I have to put it, the Afghan institution of judge, the Sitaj-e Qazai, which is basically the training of judges, has been revived, and now that is functional, which is involved in the training of judges and attorneys. But also, there have been other programs which are run by, again, Germany, mainly the USA and Italy, which focus on the training of judges, police wardens, and attorneys. There has been some progress. It is a different question how effective the training has been. That is another issue. But formal trainings have been revived, and judges have been trained, attorneys, and police officers. In addition to this, key textbooks have been published and distributed to some key justice institutions. I want to pass a bit quickly through this. Also, there have been some progress with regard to the physical infrastructure of Afghan justice institutions. A few prisons have been built, for example, a prison for women, a facility for women, for children, and also in the south, in Gardez, a new prison has been built, and also in Mazar-e-Sharif, in the north. Other prisons have been rehabilitated, but still, as I will come to this issue later, other institutions are still really not in a situation that are suitable for the functioning of judicial institutions. Finally, there has been also some progress with regard to legislation. Many laws have been amended in the spirit and context of the new developments in Afghanistan, in the context of the post-war, post-Taliban administration. But also, five new laws have been fully adopted, and 14 other laws have been, or drafts have been introduced, and they're with the legislature now. So this is within the past 2 years, especially because we have just about 2 years from the establishment of the new parliament. There has been some progress. However, as I said at the introduction, the task of rebuilding and strengthening the Afghan justice system is huge, and it is complex. So this minor progress is overshadowed by the problems of the justice system, which involves professional skills and education of judges. As you could see, first, before I go to the diagram, a requirement of a government and a judge is to have a university degree in Sharia or in law, and also to have a 1 year judicial training. But in reality, only about half of the current working judges have a university degree and judicial training. The almost 50% of the judges or either graduate of madrasas, religious schools, or they are graduate of other faculties, for example, pharmacy, but work as judges, or they, in fact, do not have a university degree at all, as 20%, one-fifth of them do not have, you can see the last figure, 20% do not have a university degree at all. The problems also relates to or involves also access of legal and professional resources. As you can see from the table, 36% of the judges, of course this was a sample as selected as sample which is based on the Supreme Court survey, do not have access to statutes and other governmental regulations. 54% do not have textbooks on the law, and you could see 82% do not have access to written decision by the Supreme Court, and again another 80% do not have support from professional support from an experienced mentor or a judge. Physical infrastructure. Although there has been some progress made, but the progress is really very little. For example, this is a courthouse in Kamar district of Nangarhar province. I took the photo in 2006. It is called functioning court. There were three judges, but they were sitting outside this building because you could see these are the windows of the. There was nothing inside. And they were sitting in the shadow of a tree, and the clerk was sitting on the ground. The judges were sitting on two charpayis, which basically are beds, which was used both as a bed and as a chair, as chairs. There were no stationery, or there were just a few pages, and there were no physical security. There was a lot of fresh air, of course, and a good view. But really, this was, to me, not a functioning court. When I asked a senior official, I told him, how do you class this court? He said, oh, it certainly is functioning. So this is a physical infrastructure which is not conducive, really, to holding a trial. The other crucial issue is the lack of trust in the formal justice system. I'll come to this later. Of course, if you don't have that kind of physical infrastructure, if you don't have professional judicial officers, and if there is corruption, how could people trust a court or an institution of justice? This survey is conducted by Asia Foundation last year. People were asked that with the questions here, who do you trust the most to resolve any dispute that you may have? Only 17% of the people say that they would trust formal government court. That is, say, whether local leaders, elders, shura, these are all informal mechanisms or institutions or authority, figures of authority of dispute settlement. So this is another issue, the lack of trust, lack of confidence in the justice system. Before going to the informal justice system, there is another problem with the justice institutions. The African justice institutions, which mainly include the judiciary, attorney general's office, the police, and the prison, they really do not work as a system. They are in many ways independent from one another. They do not communicate with one another. And you know, the justice system, it has to work like a chain. Otherwise, really, we cannot call it as a system. Also, those who are involved in the rebuilding of justice system, mainly the United States, Germany, and Italy, they do not have really an effective coordination. They don't have a vision, really. They don't have a strategy. They may have a strategy, but they don't have a coherent vision within which they could rebuild the justice system in a way that delivers justice effectively. And as I alluded to earlier, the question of corruption, it is endemic. Corruption is institutionalized. I don't want to go into details, but Transparency International's recent study said that the people in Afghanistan saw courts as one of the most corrupt institutions. So with all this problem with the justice system, it is obvious that people do not trust them, and people do not go for to them, do not take their disputes for resolution. In Afghanistan, traditionally, for centuries, we had jirgas and shuras, which are basically informal institutions of dispute settlement. I don't want to go to the formal definition, but people, elders, get together, the disputants take their disputes to them, their villager, they sit in a circle, and they find a solution to this dispute. They generally apply ORF. ORF means Afghan customary law. It is also called NARCH. Some in the East is called Shinwar law among the Shinwaris, the way of the Shinwars. This era used to study show this. These people sit together, they use these customary law as guides, and then find solution to the dispute. But a solution that really is acceptable to both disputants, if they are, it is a criminal case, to the offender and to the victim, and to the community, because the community is involved. The main focus of Jirga is on reconciliation of the offender and the victim, especially, and the disputants. It is not about retribution. It is about if there is an offense, reintegration of the offender back into the community. In fact, you want to look at the main outcomes of Jirga and Shura. So the font is very slow, very small. Two-thirds, respondents were asked, about 2,300 respondents, two-thirds say that the main outcome of Jirga and Shura was sulh. Sulh basically is reconciliation of disputants. About 50% said it was compensation of the victim. About 40% say that it was the outcome also involved the exclusion of offenders from the community, ratal, which means the ostracization of offenders. But also, very disturbingly, about 20% say that it was the outcome was bad. Bad basically means using women as a tool for the resolution of dispute. For example, if there is an offender and victim, and the Jirga may decide that the offender's close relative, a woman, get married to the close relative of the victim. But of course, this is not only against human rights principles, but against Islamic Sharia and against Afghan law. But this does happen with Jirga. Also, sometimes within Jirga, there are people, informal police, they're not police, but they are basically they enforce Jirga's decision in the south called Arbakyan. They, if there is no other way to enforce the Jirga's decision through social pressure, through other mechanisms, they burn the offender's house. So crime is used as a mechanism of social control. But what is crucial here is, in fact, the main outcome of Jirga is compensation of the victim and reconciliation of the disputants, the victims and offenders. And this has very close similarities to a new paradigm in modern criminology and criminal justice, which is restorative justice. The emphasis of restorative justice is on the restoration of relationships between victims and offenders, but also between the two and the community. Because crime affects not only the victim, but also the and the community. So in this way, Jirga, while traditional institution, paradoxically, is in many ways has very modern aspects. In fact, more modern than the thinking of 20th and 19th centuries legal scholars, because restorative justice and a most recent paradigm in modern criminal justice and criminology. So, one of the main recommendations of this report is how to harness the positive aspect of Jirga, the restorative aspects of Jirga, and at the same time monitor its negative aspects. How to make Jirga a restorative-based institution, restorative justice-based institution, most accessible as it is and effective, but at the same time monitor that it does not violate fundamental human rights in Afghan constitution. So one of the outcome of this report is the emergence of a new model, which we call it hybrid model. This basically involves the establishment of an ADR, Alternative Dispute Resolution Unit, and a human rights unit, alongside the formal justice institutions. That means that instead of taking all civil and criminal issues to the formal justice system, people would have the choice to take their civil disputes either to the formal justice system or to the EDR. Also, they could take their minor criminal incidents, minor, not serious criminal. The Afghan criminal law divided into three categories. Here is the two less serious categories. To the Jirga unit, to the ADR unit, that could be best. It could be Jirga, Shura, or community dispute, community development councils, or private arbitration. If they find a solution that is satisfactory to both the offenders and the victim and to the disputants, the decision must go to the human rights unit in order to ensure that it does not violate women's rights. It does not violate human rights. After that, it could be recorded and the decision could be legally binding. Although it is already morally and socially binding, but it could also be legally binding. Serious crimes must only be dealt with the formal justice system. Well, first of all, for example, issues of murder, they're too complex for Jirga people to investigate them and to resolve them. Although some people say that even that could be dealt with by Jirga, especially if it has, you know, the two aspects of the rights of God and the rights of the people. Human rights units. Afghanistan, in fact, in the past 30 years, as I'm sure you know about, that there have been serious violations of human rights. In fact, a culture of human rights violation has emerged. I think it is, we thought that it is necessary. In fact, it is based on our findings on a questionnaire that there is the human rights violation, past including past crimes, and especially violence against women, is dealt with more informally by human rights unit. If it is acceptable, for example, to husband and wife, to people who are related through intimate relationships, then that's fine. If it is not, then it could go through the formal justice system. And in fact, even in the West, in the United States and in the UK, domestic violence issues, police are not really effective in dealing with it. The courts, because it's difficult to investigate. It's a private issue. There is no evidence. And it's, in many cases, people say that, well, this is my personal, private issue, although it's a breach of law. But, you know, at the same time, it is too private. So we thought that with the establishment of these two units within the formal justice system, on the one hand, the justice system could become more effective, more accessible, more cost-effective, because Jirga could resolve a dispute within a day or two, 3 days, but the court and the justice system, the resolution of a dispute will take not only months, but maybe years. I'm just putting it in 1 minute, yes. Yeah, okay. We, of course, this is a model that has emerged from our research. We don't want plan that this should be imposed. We want this to be tested empirically, whether it works or not. So we estimated that the model could be tested empirically, piloted in five provinces in the different parts of Afghanistan, and we estimated that 1 year cost of this testing could be $500,000, which in many ways is negligible compared to the spending, the money that millions of dollars is spent on the justice system. And also we recommend that the Afghanistan National Development Strategy includes this and it becomes part of its rule of law strategy. And it piloted in next year, and in 2009 the lesson learned or assessed, and if the results are encouraging, then it could be adopted by 2010. Well, I'm sorry I've taken a bit longer, but thank you very much for your attention.
I should just say, as an addendum to Ali's last remark, that with the support of the State Department, USIP is planning this year actually to implement a pilot project very much along the lines that this report is recommending. We've been working on this process symbiotically, and we all agree that it's critical that this interesting idea is actually be examined in practice on the ground, and we're hoping that that will happen this year. Now I turn it over to Barney.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks, Ali. I should also mention I am one of the international advisors on this report. I'm saying that boastfully, not because I actually did very much work. This is the second edition of the National Human Development Report of Afghanistan. And many countries around the world produce national human development reports with the help of UNDP, which of course produces annually the World Development Report. The first report, which came out 2 years ago, was pretty much a baseline report to try to just, as I recall, right, it didn't have a theme. It was just to try to collect what data there were, very little, about the basic indicators of human development and give a depiction of where Afghanistan stood. It was that report that made it possible to calculate a human development index for Afghanistan, since one of the indicators of lack of human development is lack of data, which is why, for instance, the rankings are a little bit deceptive because Somalia is not included because Somalia doesn't even have a number. And, of course, worrying about whether Afghanistan is 173rd or 174th on the list is pretty irrelevant because what all that really tells you is it's still tied for last place with a bunch of other countries that also do not have reliable data. This report is innovative in terms of human development reports in that it links human development to the rule of law. I believe, and this is what people at UNDP have told me, it's the first human development report that has chosen as its theme the rule of law. This is very consistent with the concerns of people in Afghanistan. You know that the human development model also underlies the Millennium Development Goals, which the UN set in 2000, and which Afghanistan finally wrote a report about last year. Afghanistan now has set its own Millennium Development Goals. There are 8 global Millennium Development Goals, which I won't go through, but they're what you might think. But Afghanistan added a 9th for its own program, and that 9th Millennium Development Goal for Afghanistan was security. Now, let me say something about the relationship of human development and security. Actually, let me go back and make one other point first before I go to that. Of course, I'm talking about UNDP, right, which is the UN agency that comes in peaceful times and works on development in collaboration with governments. This whole program is part of what we still refer to very misleadingly as the program of post-conflict reconstruction in Afghanistan. But of course, Afghanistan is not in a state of post-conflict reconstruction. Afghanistan is in a continuing state of conflict. And one of the core issues in that conflict is the lack of security and justice. The main legitimation of the Taliban regime, which led many people to welcome them at first, was that they brought security and justice. Now, they didn't bring security and justice according to international standards. I'll come back to what that meant in the Afghan context. And the main phenomenon that is delegitimating and weakening the government of Afghanistan today is that it has not brought security and justice. That is the same thing, which is the main thing that is weakening public support for and the legitimacy of the international presence in Afghanistan. Now, let me just go back and give you a few vignettes from my personal contact with Afghanistan. I won't go back to the period of the Soviet occupation, but let me start in 1994 when I went into Afghanistan. I went up from Peshawar toward Jalalabad. I went into Jalalabad. I was actually supposed to fly from Islamabad to Kabul in January 1994, but unfortunately, several militias switched sides and formed a coordination council against Ahmad Shah Massoud and started, among other things, bombing the airport. And therefore, the UN flights were canceled. So instead, we went into Afghanistan overland. But we did get a chance to see something of Kabul because we encountered hundreds and hundreds and eventually thousands of people from Kabul on that road because they were fleeing the fighting that was taking place in the city. And they came up to us. They were just piled in trucks, which they had to pay quite a bit of money for, in some cases their life savings. And they had maybe a little sack of clothes, and that was all. And they were just deposited by the road in an area with no water, and they had no security. Okay, they were just bodies by the road with no water. They had lost their houses and everything. And they crowded all around us and shouted about how the various armed groups had come and bombed their houses and looted them and killed people and so on and so forth. And they didn't really make any political distinctions among them. So that was insecurity, and that is why people turned even to the Taliban for some kind of security. Now, in 1998, I visited Afghanistan under the Taliban, and that visit, I flew to Kandahar, and then I drove. I stayed in Kandahar a few days. Then I drove, a driver drove me from Kandahar to Lashkargah, the center of Helmand. And I stayed overnight there. And then we drove from Lashkargah to Farah. And I have to tell you, that was one of the most boring drives of my entire life. But if you tried to do it today, you would not be bored. And we had no security. But which I mean, when I say we had no security, I mean we had no private security because there was public security. There were three Taliban checkpoints along the road, and there was no fear of being robbed, killed, attacked, or anything like that. And I stopped in tea houses and I talked to people. And they said, well, at least now we can go out without worrying about being killed. But, they said, our children are not being educated. We don't know what the future will bring. Nobody is doing anything to bring us electricity. The roads are deteriorating and deteriorating. We don't see any hope for the future. They wouldn't say under this guard, but that was the idea. So the Taliban provided that basic public security, but they didn't provide for any human development, and people do want more out of life than not being killed when you leave your house. Now, when the international community really engaged with Afghanistan after September 11th, Afghans hoped very much that that would mean they would have both security and human development, that now that the most powerful military forces in the world were there, countries that supposedly stood for human rights and so on, they would have security and justice, and also that, as they put it, sometimes Americans would come here and build lots of clinics and schools all over the place, et cetera. Okay, so they said, okay, well, they didn't do that. Now, but when I talked to, recently I met with a group of tribal leaders from various parts of, they were from eastern Afghanistan, and they were complaining about the lack of justice and security. And one of them said to me, according to Islam, if someone commits a murderer, they should be tried and executed. He said, but now that doesn't happen. Now, he didn't go on to say, now what happens is they give him a criminal defense lawyer, they have a fair trial, and it takes too long, and then they sentence him to life in prison, and he can be paroled after 14 years. No, actually, that's not what he said. What he said was, now they arrest him, and then 3 months later, he bribes someone, and he gets out. So what Afghans are actually comparing in Afghanistan today is not what they had under the Taliban and what we claim or believe we are bringing them. They're comparing what they had under the Taliban with what they actually have. And what they actually have is the situation that Ali was describing. It doesn't make them support the Taliban, but it makes them not support the government and not support the international presence, which of course creates a more permissive environment for insurgents. Now, the programs that Ali is talking about are important and vital. Mostly those are programs, and I don't mean this as a technocrat myself, as a criticism, but they are programs that are technical in nature. They involve building people's skills, training people, building buildings, and so on. That's very necessary, but it is not sufficient. In order for justice to be done and to create an environment where human development can take place safely, that has to take place within a structure of a state that actually is bound by the rule of law and enforces it. I remember I was once I was at a meeting in the UN in Kabul about there were people from UNAMA there and about judicial reform, and one guy got up who was Haitian. He said, in Haiti, he said, before the Americans came, our judges were incompetent and corrupt. Now, since the Americans came, our judges are competent and corrupt. So there is a systemic problem with who wields power. Sometimes they do have problems. They don't have legal documents and so on. But there's another problem. I know a case in Nangarhar, which kind of illustrates the way this, you heard this, but no one else has heard it yet, which illustrates the way the de facto hybrid system works in practice, which is there was a case involving two families, which basically, I won't go into the details, but it involved a jirga had decided to give the 8-year-old daughter of one family to the other family in order to resolve a dispute. And the family didn't want to give their daughter. They sent her to Pakistan, and they took it to court. And the judge said, quite rightly, this is contrary to, as Ali said, this was a case of Baud, that this is contrary to Afghan law, is contrary to human rights, and he didn't put it in this order. It's contrary to Sharia. That's the main point he made. He said, therefore, I'm ruling that it can't be done. He said, but unfortunately, I don't have the power to enforce this judgment. So you have to make some arrangement with the jirga. Okay. Because, so even if he doesn't have all the documents, nonetheless, he made the right decision, but it didn't matter. Didn't matter because there was no state that could enforce the decision. In fact, the way that the jirga's decision came about was that the sons in one of the family went and joined a militia commanded by somebody who got millions of dollars from the United States and then made millions of dollars more in drug trafficking and got weapons in order to assert their power over the members of the other family. So that is how the power was being exercised there de facto, regardless of the fact that his judge, who may have been poorly trained, but at least he knew that Baud was against Sharia. I think we must not lose sight of that basic political issue. And it's important because, you know, for all the obvious reasons, but also because it is undermining the very foundation that makes it possible to carry out these very good activities that people like Ali are doing. Now, let me just say a few words about the hybrid system. If we don't get this basic problem solved, we won't have to worry about it. But there's a I think the idea of what they call the hybrid system is a very good idea, but I want to clarify a frequent misunderstanding about it. Because people, one of the most common questions is, why are you talking about strengthening these jirgas and shuras? Wouldn't it be better to extend the formal legal system with all its protections to the entire country? And I say, yes, it would be much better. It would also be better if Afghanistan were a rich country instead of a poor country. And it would be better if it were a powerful country instead of a weak country. And it would be better if 80% of the people had PhDs instead of being illiterate. But we have to work with the Afghanistan that actually exists. And in the Afghanistan that actually exists, the formal justice system does not function, and people do not have access to it. And even if we enable it to function better, most people will still not have access to it. So the hybrid, the existence of formal and informal justice is not something that is being introduced by this concept of the hybrid system. It is a reality which is there whether you recognize it, support it or not. What they are actually proposing is not the establishment of some informal justice sector that doesn't exist, but trying to integrate in a better way the informal system, which does exist and will exist whether you support it or not, into the formal system so that it becomes a way of strengthening the formal system rather than an alternative system that undermines it. I think that's a very valuable model which could be used in other parts of the development of the country as well, provided we eventually get the basic legitimacy of state power right. Thank you.
Thanks for that. Also very illuminating remarks. I want to offer our panel here up for questions. We do have a microphone because we are recording this so that it'll be available for posterity or those who couldn't make it, at least, on the web. And so if you do have a question, I would ask that you come up to the microphone. Just based on Barney's last point, I'm going to ask the first question. All three of us participated in a conference this summer in Rome that I mentioned before. And this issue did come up in the Rome conference. And this was primarily a conference between the Afghan government and the international community. And you had the heads of the Supreme Court and the Attorney General's office and the Ministry of Justice there. They have an interest, obviously, in the strengthening of the state. And so while we have been working on this issue over the last several years, there has often been, although I think less to a lesser extent, there has often been some resistance on the part of people, both within the international community and at the heads of the Afghan government institutions, to this idea that Barney brought up of strengthening the informal system, because that's how this proposal is often perceived, that you would take the limited amount of resources that are devoted to strengthening the formal system and somehow put them into an unaccountable informal system. Together with them, there is a very vocal human rights community, largely internationally driven, but some Afghans as well, particularly in Kabul, who believe that because of the flaws of the informal system, this practice of BAD, the trading forced marriage of girls to end disputes, many people in Kabul see, well, maybe not many people in Kabul, but people who voice this opinion see the informal system, which is not ultimately necessarily accountable to some to rule of law in the sense that we say that there are well-known plies, that are well-known rules that are equally enforced and that allow access to everybody, including women, and that to engage in this sort of practice, in fact, supports the denigration of human rights and justice in Afghanistan. I might have a little trouble making the argument because I'm usually on the other side of it, but I want you guys to respond to it. I think you started to, Bonnie, but I want you to respond to it because I think it is a very important strand that still exists, particularly within Kabul, that the recommendations of this report will encounter resistance from. Maybe starting with you, Ollie, and then...
Well, yeah, first, I just wanted to mention that this international human rights community is not something that's not present in the room. I consider myself a part of it, and I haven't been excommunicated yet. Let me just say a few words about how human rights fits into this in general. First, there is a valid reason for there are several valid reasons for concerns of this nature, namely the human rights violations that are committed by the informal system. But again, what often happens is people compare the informal system as it actually exists with the formal system as we imagine it. For instance, they say in the informal system, women have no access, whereas under the Afghan constitution, women and men have equal rights. Well, that's fine. But if you actually go to an Afghan court, I don't think you'll see much evidence that women and men have equal rights. In fact, you won't see much difference in the gender composition of a normal Afghan formal court procedure and an Afghan jirga procedure, because they're both part of the same society. So it's not really fair to compare something that really exists with something that we're only imagining. And they have to actually live in the real Afghanistan, not in the one that we're imagining for them. And the human rights that they have are the ones that are actually protected, not the ones that we imagine we can project onto them through certain documents. So that's one point. Now, the idea of the hybrid system is, in fact, to improve human rights protection in the informal system, which I emphasize again, will continue to exist whether you recognize it or not, because there is no substitute for it. In other words, the funds will not be diverted into, there's another legitimate concern, which is there are a lot of stupid programs in Afghanistan, if I may, and everywhere. And for instance, I can't verify it's true, but one person, this was Maryam from UNIFEM, told me that there's some program where somebody is conducting, some foreign NGO is conducting workshops to teach Afghan tribal elders how to resolve conflicts. Okay. This is a good example of money that is being wasted, okay? Because they already know that. That's why people turn to them. And the foreigners don't know how to resolve conflicts in Afghanistan. So it would be better if they put it more into the formal system. But in fact, that's not what they're advocating, having conflict resolution seminars for tribal elders so that they learn how to do what they've been doing for centuries. If you look at the specific proposals, it was actually to invest in the formal system through an alternative dispute resolution unit and a human rights body in order to give the formal system the capacity to interact more systematically with the formal system to give the formal system the capacity to interact with the informal system and thereby bring it more into the ambit of the formal system. Now, let me just add, there's one misconception. Unfortunately, the misconception is reflected in the title of the report, which is about tradition and modernity. As if the formal system is modernity, which of course is represented by us, and the informal system is tradition, which is something that Afghans are now doing in exactly the same way that they've been doing it for centuries, since, as we all know, they're living in the 14th or the 15th or whatever century where they are said to be living in. Actually, that is not true. Afghans are living in the 21st century. It's just that they got the raw end of it and not the part of it that we did. And these jirgas are modern institutions which have adapted in a very dynamic way to a situation, a typical 20th and 20th century, 21st century phenomenon, by the way, which is devastating civil war funded by billions of dollars from outside powers, which is something that did not exist in the 16th century. They have adjusted to that, and they have developed tremendous capacities in that informal system as a way of coping with that unprecedented situation. They are actually, you know, they have those capacities. It's very important it's very important to try to find the means to use those capacities in order to strengthen the constitutional system rather than thinking that you can treat Afghanistan as a tabula rasa and bring to it something modern that it didn't have before.
Do you want to add to that?
Yes. In fact, I fully support what Bonnie said. But the whole purpose of introducing a human rights unit is that the decisions by Jirga and Shura are monitored by the human rights unit. And if they are not satisfied, then that decision is invalid. So why should the human rights activists or institutional organizations have any concern? In fact, we propose that those people, the same people who you think may criticize, we want them to be involved in this process. In fact, to monitor the decision of informal justice institutions. So I don't see any concern for them. On the contrary, they would have more active participation in monitoring the decisions made by informal justice institutions.
Thanks. Please go ahead and please introduce yourself when you ask a question.
As-salam. I'm John Newstrom with KBAC Incorporated. I was the InterNews country director in Afghanistan for a while. I was there for the presidential election. But I was not there for the big Loya Jirga when the Constitution was developed. But in the meetings that those of us doing democracy development were having at USAID and also talking to journalists who covered that, I came away with a concept I'd like to see if you guys can refute or tell me that, you know, it's absolutely wrong. They said that the United States did a great job organizing this in a way and letting the Afghans do their traditional methods, but they were zeroed in on parliamentary elections and presidential elections and ignored the judiciary. As a result, we are now crippled by having a judiciary system that went the wrong way. And the example most often used that I heard was that the Supreme Court does not have to have cases appear before them. No one has to come with a petition. They can just rule on things. So even when I was in Afghanistan, I was seeing the Supreme Court make a ruling, for example, since I worked in media, about how certain programs couldn't be on the radio or television because they were against Islam, which put President Karzai in a position of either siding with the court and being considered pro-Islam or siding against the court for free media and free speech, but then opening himself up to be criticized for being pro-American instead of pro-Islam. So I guess my question is, did we win a battle but lose the war by not paying attention to the judiciary at the beginning? Or do I have a misconception here? I just wanted to see from you guys what you thought of the top of the judiciary system.
Of course, Bonnie, with your permission, there is less investment. There was not as much attention paid to rebuilding the judiciary as it was, for example, paid to the police or to the army. But I think the African judiciary has gone through a process of evolution. At the very beginning, yes, it was very conservative. The people who made the main decisions were religious scholars. But in the past years, the judiciary, especially the senior justices, are highly educated. They are experienced judges. And also the chief justice is educated both in the United States and in Al-Azhar. So I don't think it is necessarily an institution that have a specific ideological, focus. But I agree that there has been less attention paid to the judiciary as compared to the police and to the army. And probably the main reason is because the United States has been too much focusing on security rather than, providing justice to the Africans.
Well, I just answer as an American. It's the problem was that the administration's approach to Afghanistan from the beginning was based on a very narrow definition of counterterrorism, namely killing and capturing terrorists, and the doctrine under Donald Rumsfeld that what we do is we wage wars and we want other people to clean up after them. To do peace, we don't do peacekeeping, we don't do reconstruction, we want NATO and UN and so on to do that. The result was the U.S. took on the responsibility of building the Afghan National Army. But it built it basically to act as an auxiliary army to help fight against the enemies of the United States, not as an integrated component of a security sector for Afghanistan. That was for other people to worry about, and it wasn't well funded, it wasn't well coordinated, it wasn't well conceived, and that's of a piece with the entire operation. Now, several years too late, they have woken up to that, and the Afghanistan Compact says all the right things about it. But I'd say I was at the negotiations over the bond agreement, and we put in the bond agreement, Civil Service Commission, Judicial Commission, International Assistance, Security Force, and so on. The United States came with two proposals. One, there has to be a statement saying that the Afghan government will cooperate in the fight against terrorism. Two, there have to be elections.
Hello, I'm Wade Channel. I'm from USAID. I had the privilege last February of being on a team that did a commercial legal environment assessment, and I looked at court, and this is just a statement. I love what you're saying. It's what I recommended as well. Let's recognize the reality of the Jirgas and the Shuras, and give an appellate procedure perhaps for the human rights issues to get them out of there and so on. I'm thrilled to hear that you're saying it makes me feel like I got it right, and I'm always a little worried about whether I get things right when I'm only there for a couple of weeks. So the official recommendations of the report, which therefore are USAID official recommendations, fully support you. So good to know that, and that might be useful in certain circumstances. But with that, I have a question. You described cultural differences here, a system that's based on reconciliation, reconstruction of society, keeping the social fabric together a little better, especially after a hostile environment. And this, my findings and understandings there in a very brief time, of course, is there's a huge tradition of consensus building, coming together to discuss, work out, and come up with solutions that people can accept and are therefore legitimate within the general population. You also mentioned briefly lawmaking, and much of the lawmaking related to the judiciary as well as the commercial lawmaking is being managed and funded fairly heavily by the various foreign donors and foreign helpers in Afghanistan. What's your sense of how well the lawmaking system is capturing the consensus culture of Afghanistan, and do you see any implications for legitimacy, whether it's in the way what the laws come up with in terms of structure of courts or the content of laws in terms of anything from bankruptcy to company law to whatever? Are you finding that the lawmaking system that is in place is really harmonious with the Afghan society and Afghan values?
Well, I think the problem is not values. The problem is, again, this imaginary Afghanistan versus the real one. If you want, the reason that Afghan society has decision-making methods based on consultation and consensus rather than on majority rule is not because they have different values. It's because there's no way to enforce a decision that's made by majority rule. If you want a decision actually to be carried out, it has to be a consensual decision because the state is weak or non-existent. So therefore, you have a system of making decisions by consensus, and decisions that are made by consensus can then be implemented. If you then bring in you import wholesale a decision-making and lawmaking process that is based on highly technical majority rule base, you'll get a bunch of nice laws, but they will not be implemented. So if you want to have a functioning legal system or a functioning any kind of policy, you have to start with what can be implemented. And then you have to have a decision-making process which is consistent with the modes of implementation that are actually available. That is why in the past what Afghan states was, they made decisions and laws about a very, very limited area, subjects. In fact, there was no written legal code in Afghanistan until the 1960s. But when the Afghan king decided that they really wanted something to be done, then he would go out, and if you didn't do it, they would kill you or torture you, you know, and they would get that one or two things done, you know, that they needed to get done. And that was the tools that they had available to them. I'm merely observing a fact rather than, making a value judgment about it. But so again, it goes back to thinking that you can introduce democratic majority rule modes of decision making without building the structures of administration, implementation, and dispute resolution that makes it possible to carry out those decisions. Because when you impose majority rule on a society that does not have a state, you do not get democracy, you get conflict.
I think Bona's answer is complete, but I just want to add, yes, the taqneen or the law drafting department, Minister of Justice, has been strengthened. It's also supported by advisors, international advisors. So it is relatively more competent than it was before. But there is a problem with the process, because it has to go to the legislature, to the two houses of parliament. It takes quite a long time. I mean, in the past 2 years, only five laws have been fully adopted. But also, one must be frank, to me, the legislature really does not represent the Afghan society fully. There is factionalism, and also those who have more influence, they also influence lawmaking in the interest of those who are already powerful. So I'm hesitant to say that the law really, represent consensus or the collective consciousness of Afghan society, but at least it is better than it was before.
I would just add that there is some interesting section here on transitional justice and dealing with past abuses. And in light of what Ali just said, I think that without knowing for sure, I would say that the fastest of the five laws to have sailed through the parliament was in fact the law proclaiming amnesty for parliamentarians for past crimes that they may have committed.
No, for everyone, not just for parliamentarians.
Right. Go ahead.
The law is so poorly drafted that it actually does not give amnesty to anyone for anything.
Hello. My name is Wahid Fakhiri, and I'm an Afghan-American. I recently traveled to Kandahar, Kabul, and Herat, and what I saw is basically the Karzai government is facing a lack of trust among the people, and there is a crisis of legitimacy. And that comes through the beginning of the Afghan wars, where America and the international community allied itself with some notorious personality in Afghanistan in Afghan war, who Afghans see them as a criminal. And the parliament itself is a collection where notorious Afghans are there, personalities are there, and people do not trust, because they see these people who destroy their homes, who destroy their cities, who destroy their lives, are still in power. These Americans, America's higher guns are completely discredited, and I think that's probably the biggest obstacle in bringing a stable Afghanistan. And my question is, how can you reconcile, on the one hand, a government which is run by such a personalities, and on the other hand, bring in law and order? Law and order is connected to legitimacy, and legitimacy does not exist. Thank you.
Well, I don't know that I need to comment on that further. That's a very well stated point, and it's pretty much the one that I was making in my talk. So, I mean, the question is, what is the relationship of technical training and capacity building and so on to the way that power is exercised? Sometimes people call it political will, but it's not, you know, just something voluntary that you can bring into being. You know, it has to do with the nature of who is exercising power. And it means that for these programs are necessary, but as I said, but not sufficient, for them actually to create a system that will function. The very way that power is exercised has to be transformed.
Yeah, I agree. I think I share your observations in Afghanistan. The existence of people who have much blood on their hands and who are currently involved in land grabbing and in corruption that delegitimizes President Karzai's administration. But I think his concerns are that, and hope are that reintegrating these people into the system might be a mechanism for controlling them. But it doesn't seem to be working. In fact, key figures in his government are involved in activities that delegitimize and give bad name to his administration. I agree.
Good afternoon. My name is Ozzy Taranjbar. I'm a graduate student at George Mason. And I actually wanted to ask a question about the amnesty law. I was wondering if, in your opinion, you think it adds to a culture of impunity in Afghanistan, and if it has impeded efforts for reconciliation. And I also had a question about the Jirgas. Do you think that the Jirgas can be used to address some of these past crimes? And also, the sources that Jirgas use, do they use customary law, Pashtunwali, for example, Sharia law? And if it is Sharia, is it Hanafi, Jafari? How do we use Jirga law in areas where there's Sunni and Shiites and that type of authority? Thank you.
Shall I come to the first, second part of your question first? Again, I'm using the ARU's observation. They did research, Afghanistan Research and Evaluation Unit, extensive research, ethnographic research about dispute settlement in Bamiyan, in Yakaulang district. And they found that people routinely take their cases to ulama, and they are also called shurai ulama, although they have some kind of official sanctioning too. So when Shura or Jirga or in an area where people are Shiite, they use generally Jafari jurisprudence or Shiite jurisprudence in general. But in other parts of Afghanistan, for example, in the east, they use customary law. It has different names in different places called among Shinwaris, the Shinwar tribe, the Shinwar law, the way of the Shinwars. So it is their customary law. In other parts in the south, it is mainly it's called Nurkh. So, in fact, Jirga is not a kind of uniform. It is very varied, and it depends. It operates in a very flexible way in different contexts. The whole purpose is reconciliation. The first part, I think the amnesty law encourages a culture of impunity. And what is very interesting is that the amnesty law was introduced and supported by those who were the main violators of human rights in Afghanistan. To me, it is a setback, a serious setback.
I don't think there's actually a culture of impunity in Afghanistan. I think there's a state of impunity in Afghanistan, which is actually a violation of the people's culture. Which demands moral responsibility, moral and criminal responsibility. Second, As a political event, obviously the passage of the so-called reconciliation law strengthened those who are against accountability for past crimes. But as a law itself, it did absolutely nothing. And partly there is tremendous confusion in Afghanistan about what this accountability for past crimes means. And I would say in some cases, justifiable fear on the parts of people who took part in the war that they will be prosecuted selectively for political reasons. Because if you read the text of the reconciliation law, it actually does not give amnesty for any human rights violations. It does not give amnesty for crimes against humanity, for war crimes. It only talks about amnesty for fighting, for acts of war. Now, after every civil war, you do give an amnesty for acts of war that took place. And the accountability, and in other words, if someone took up arms against the government and killed a government soldier, you don't try them for murder. You say, okay, that was an act of war. And now we memorialize all those deaths and so on. But, of course, if they massacred civilians, that's a different matter. That's a war crime. Now, people are not at all clear on this distinction in Afghanistan. And people who, and sometimes when people say they might be tried for war crimes, they think they're being tried for war as a crime. So there's a lot of clarity that's needed. And, of course, given the reality of the way the legal system actually functions in Afghanistan, rather than the way we might be imagining it, it is quite reasonable for people to think that if they were charged with a crime, even one they actually committed, it would not be it would be unjust. Because, for instance, right now, one of the most notorious human rights violators in Afghan history, Asadullah Sarwari, who was head of Hafizullah Amin's secret police and was responsible for the death of thousands or tens of thousands of people, is being tried or has recently been tried. Anyway, every human rights organization has looked at his trial, said it's a complete travesty, and you know he shouldn't be punished on the basis of that trial. So, and then there are other people at the, and he is guilty of you know all those things and a lot more probably. But at the same time, plenty of other people aren't being tried, so it's difficult. Now, in terms of actually, Jurgis and Shuras have already been used all across Afghanistan to deal with past crimes. And that is why a lot of the villages are calm, because people from different factions have gone back and they have settled their property disputes, they have settled their... But you cannot use Jurgis and Shuras to deal with national political figures, or even provincial political figures, or people who have strong connections to one or the other foreign intelligence agencies, and so on. That requires some kind of political means. On the role of Sharia... Actually, this is actually a big question, which is usually not understood very well, and I won't claim I understand it well either. I've just started to understand it the last couple of years. Sharia is part of the formal system of justice in Afghanistan. It is also part of the informal system. First of all, Sharia is not a code of law that you can compare to other codes of law. Sharia is a system of jurisprudence. In Afghanistan, until the 1960s, there were no codes of law. The king established courts of Sharia who enforced Sharia as they understood it, and the government published handbooks of fiqh, of jurisprudence, to give the judges guidance on how they should interpret Sharia. This was Sharia of Hanafi fiqh, which was at that time the official religion of Afghanistan, Islam of Hanafi fiqh. And they had these handbooks to guide the judges in how they should engage in jurisprudence, but they did not have written codes. The written codes came into being in the 1960s, but the written codes were not exhaustive. The Constitution adopted in the 1960s, at the same time as the written codes, said that whenever there is no written code, jurisprudence of the Hanafi fiqh shall be applied. And the Constitution today says the same thing, that where there is no written code, jurisprudence of the Hanafi school should be applied, except there's another article that says in cases involving personal law among Shia, then fiqh tashayyu, jurisprudence of the Shia should be applied, which includes both the Twelvers and the Ismailis, which are different schools of law. And now when people in Bamiyan, which is a Shia area, probably, go to Shura of Ulama, it's not really helpful to ask whether what they're doing is formal or informal, because they do have a form of customary law among the Hazaras, But that would not be with ulama. That would be with elders, with maybe a mullah as an advisor. When they go to ulama, they're thinking, that is the law. That's what law is. Law is Sharia. And these are the people who are the custodians of it. Now, unfortunately, those people, from their point of view, were not recognized as the custodians of that law by previous Afghan states, which recognized only Hanafi ulama. Now that is changing to some extent.
In case you didn't get all of that straight in your head, we do have a paper outside that was published by the U.S. Institute of Peace, written by myself and two other authors, called The Clash of Two Goods. And I don't know if we ran out of copies, but it explores the history of the development and the use of jurisprudence, both in the formal and the informal system, much as our two speakers just laid out, and describes a little bit of the diversity that exists on both planes. And this question of how Islam, or what we call in the report folk Sharia, is often used in the customary system, because there is a very heavy reliance on Sharia, although those who are employing it often are not well versed in it, and decisions that are made that are said to be in congruence with the particular Sharia interpretation that area uses, which a Sharia scholar may tell you is completely against what the Sharia says, but it's employed very strongly within that system.
Well, if there is a written code, then the written code will be applied.
Right, but if there's not,
if there's not a written code, then the Hanafi fiqh would be applied. Yeah, as I understand, well,
yes, if it's a case between Sunni and Shia, I think it's.
Can I clarify this? You know, the provision for Afghan Shia, it just relates to personal issues, inheritance, divorce, and marriage, nothing else.
Okay.
So otherwise, it is Hanafi. Yes. Yeah.
Let's just take the last two questions together if we can, and then we'll leave the last 5 minutes to the panelists to wrap up.
Thanks. Blair King from USAID. I have two quick questions. One is on the content of the non-formal system of justice and vis-a-vis sort of international human rights norms. You've mentioned the BAD and the issues with gender and women's rights. Are there other aspects that are matters of concern vis-a-vis of the non-formal sort of content vis-a-vis human rights norms? And then my second question is regarding the hybrid model that you've proposed, in which, as I understand your explanation, you want to create these two new units, the ADR and the human rights units, as a way to link the non-formal system to the formal system and thereby sort of service the needs of the population better. But my question is, from the standpoint of the tribal elders and those in the non-formal system, what's their incentive for joining this proposed system? In other words, if from their perspective they don't think their system is broken, why should they fix it by linking it to anything else? So I'm wondering, what are the incentives in the pilot project and other, for them to actually participate in this model as you've proposed?
We'll just take the last question and you can answer them both together, if that's okay.
Leonard Rubenstein, Physicians for Human Rights. Given the problems in dealing with formal issues of justice, for the last 5-6 years, there's been really very little movement on issues of past war crimes. But over the last few months, there have been activities by the Human Rights Commission and others, and a fair amount of even political demonstrations, seeking by families seeking information about atrocities that were committed, particularly investigations of mass graves. And there's some movement on that. Now, given the question is, what do you think of make of that? On the assumption that even if there are investigations, there won't be any capacity to prosecute anybody. Do you think these investigations should go forward, will go forward? And I just appreciate your perspective on this whole process.
I'll answer the first one. With regard to the content of customary law and juridica, there are other problems too. In fact, our questionnaire asks people that who are the main decision makers. 12% say that also the decisions are influenced by warlords, who until very recently were basically holding the African population as hostages. But when we were conducting the research, we asked people that
what do you think the influence of warlords and local strongmen? They said most local strongmen have become magistrates or members of the parliament, so we are freer now. So the influence of warlords and local strongmen now has decreased significantly, especially in the area where you did research. So that's another concern. But still, of course, manipulation, personal, social, social influence may sometimes affect the outcome of Jirga unfavorably or in an unfair way. But if you compare that with the former system, it is much, much better because people, the villagers are sitting there, they see the decision. If it's unfair, they say, well, this is unacceptable, we take it to a second Jirga. It is a kind of appeal system also. So the contents, this is another problem with it, with the content. With regard to the second part of your question, which was the incentives. It is already happening, as Bonnie earlier alluded to. In fact, again, mentioning Yori's study, in many cases, judges actually send that when a case is referred to a judge or a judicial official, they said that, okay, take it to Jirga. When the Jirga decided, then we will stamp it for you. So that, in fact, tribal leaders are already involved in decision-making, judicial decision-making. What doesn't happen is there is not the formal recognition that should have been there. And the formal recognition will, on the one hand, regulate it, control its potential violations, and at the same time, the decision of Jirga will be not only socially and morally binding, but also legally binding, and we will have a record of what has been decided.
Well, I'm just a comment about that. First, there are other elements of the informal system that are violations of human rights, such as you mentioned, very common practice of collective punishment and burning people's houses down and so on. However, again, what people tend to do is they compare the reality of the informal system with some imagined idea they have of the formal system. Okay, so if we say, what is the formal system? Well, the formal system is one where police pick you up for nothing and hold you in jail for several days and beat you until you pay a bribe. That's the formal system of justice, okay? Not whatever is written in the Constitution. So that's why people say that in practice, the informal system, whatever its abuses are, is fairer than the formal system, okay? It's really not fair to compare, like, you know, Marx's idea of pure communism with the reality of capitalism, and you know, the same thing applies here. Now, on the issue of transitional justice, actually, it's not only past crimes that aren't being punished. It's also current crimes. I mean, you mentioned ARU. ARU has an office in the center of Kabul, which is right around the corner from the Interior Ministry. Somebody, a bunch of armed guys came in there in broad daylight and robbed the safe. Okay? What did the police do? They arrested all the employees, beat a bunch of them, and then they let them go. That's it. Now, they think they actually know who is there. It's an ex-employee who was responsible, an ex-employee who was fired, who was disgruntled, you know, and then he got, and so on. But the police do not have the capacity to execute, to investigate or prosecute an armed robbery taking place practically next to their headquarters in the center of Kabul. Okay. So how can this state investigate massive crimes that were carried out by some of the most powerful people in the country over the past 20 years? It cannot. Now, the basic problem is, and it's not even a question of the capacity of the judicial system, because the judicial system is used for settling dispute, either civil law, which is disputes that take place within a consensually accepted framework of law, or crime, which is a deviant activity carried out by a small proportion of the population against the wishes of, you know, against the consensus of the entire population. Right? You're a criminologist, right? Crime, law enforcement, crime control is control of social deviance, right? You cannot use law enforcement and crime control to change the configuration of power in your society. You cannot use law enforcement to get rid of one-third of your economy, for instance, like drug. You cannot use law enforcement to change who is in power in your society. Okay, so it is basically a political question. It is not a legal question. The question is who is in power and how do they exercise that power? And people will continue to demonstrate. There will continue to be investigations, but the relations will not change until those political questions are addressed.
Well, I greatly appreciate everybody coming out today. I want to thank our partners, UNDP, for putting on this event with us. I want to thank Ali and the Center for Policy and Human Development for doing this great work. And I want to thank Barney for giving us his time and enlightening us. And thank you all for coming today.